Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 121 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is my very lovely hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I had kind of a crappy weekend, but I'm doing a lot better now. And, no, I really don't have anything to banter about, interestingly enough. Well, other than the topics, but I got nothing for here. How about you?
Oh, God. I don't.
Well, that good, huh?
Yeah. No. My week's been crap.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it's just we're moving into school, and it's the I think it was Oddball was talking about, like, I think it was Nashville. They literally put out a thing where parents are not allowed to listen in on the classes. And it's like, guess what? I'm definitely going to be listening now. And that's probably been my mind. So it's one of those, like, I've been tied to her doing it in some school, mostly just to get the speed and to iron out the things. I'm not concerned that she's being indoctrinated in the first grade, but it has meant that, like, I have had, like, no spare time, and just Murphy's Law is just striking like crazy for lots of people. I mean, there's there are people, there's some bad stuff that's going on with it within the ACP family, some bad news. They have not specifically spoken about it, and I didn't get a chance to talk to them before the show to know how they felt, but if you know what I'm talking about, our heart goes out to them, because they've had worse weeks than we have. But, like, for my more mundane problems, our dishwasher died in, I think it was late June. And if you've encountered anybody who's had an appliance die during the COVID times, you will know that there is a nationwide shortage in appliances.
I did not know that.
Yeah. It's washing machines, dishwashers, refrigerators, ovens. They're all the factories. I don't know if it's necessarily if that's the restrictions of the space or all that, but they're just not producing as much, and so it is absolutely mad. It's like ammo in the appliance world. Just the we've got what we've got. Please don't ask any more, and I don't know when we're getting more, and so it took us until last week to get a dishwasher. And so I've been like, my wife's like, you know, you're keeping up really good with the dishes. I'm not okay. Yes, I'm keeping up with the dishes. No, I'm not okay. This is not sustainable. My hands are all inflamed and ragged and horrible, and that's with wearing dish gloves. Ugh. And so finally, dishwasher comes. Happy day is here. And even got the setup where they called the plumber to the company just delivered the dishwasher and hauled away the old one. And so called the plumber the day before saying, hey, any way we can get you in sooner rather than later? And they're like, actually, we got somebody free that evening. So literally the company dropped off the dishwasher and the plumber showed up to hook it all up. And he found there was all sorts of troubles with the dishwasher. And as we used it, we found all sorts of troubles. Like the racks don't fit. Like the trays that hold the dishes don't roll in and out smoothly. And they were having trouble like connecting it with the counter and all this stuff. And finally, it's just like, ugh. So I called them back and I'm just like, all right, I need you guys to see whether or not, like, please tell me what's going on with this damn thing. And he's like, yeah, no, it's this. And that's something that was wrong with the factory. And so we called the company that we bought the dishwasher from, and they finally came in today. And and he's just like, yeah. I mean, if this was normal times, I'd just like send the truck around and take this one back and give you a brand new one. But we don't have any of those around, and don't know when we're getting any more. So, yeah, I'm going to go back to the shop and I'm going to show some pictures to some people and see what they have to say. And maybe we can order some parts and fix it. So, yeah, we got a dishwasher, and it's it doesn't work. It works well enough that I could wash dishes in it, but it feels like the dishwasher in my first apartment. Something that has been rode hard, put away wet, abused, dealt with by people who don't care about it, and on its last legs, and it's brand new and expensive.
Well, you actually reminded me of something. The governor of Florida actually opened the state back up.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and I haven't really experienced much because I'm pretty much a hermit by design anyway. But it'll make life a lot easier for my parents because mom hates having to rely on a cell phone. She doesn't like them. She doesn't want one. And she's like, I'm going to have to get one because, you know, when you show up for an appointment, you got to call before you go in. And that was driving her crazy. And so DeSantis has, well, he hasn't declared you must open up. It's a case of, well, if you want to, you can. Mm-hmm. And he's leaving it up to individuals to make up their own minds. Yay, liberty. And of course, we've got the predictable people just, you know, constructing little red schoolhouses from their anuses because of this. And so that's something I have to put up with. But, you know, hopefully that'll be a return to normalcy for us. But you are upset about washing dishes. My parents, they're really big TV watchers. Mm-hmm. And when I say really big TV watchers, like the TV comes on like about 5:30 and doesn't shut off until about 10 o'clock. And they are starting to get really sort of itchy because the fall programs haven't come out. You know, it's like, where is the new NCIS? Where is the new this? Where is the new that? And I'm like, I don't know. And that was something that I was just sort of idly pondering. Because Hollywood, both TV and movie, is just taking massive losses for the past 6 months mm-hmm. or so. I mean, at what point will they eventually say, this is unsustainable for us? You know, either we have to open up or basically the entertainment industry in America is going to die. And when that happens, when it, not when it dies, but when it comes to, well, we got to do one thing or the other, we can't continue on, that'll be interesting.
Also, I heard a bunch of things when this first started, that a bunch of people were going to be doing like dramas over like Zoom meetings or doing like essentially a Zoom meeting format show, essentially making whatever show idea they're going actually happening in 2020 on lockdown, so that essentially not only are you, not only are you creating that unique 2020 feel. Oh God, can you imagine what, like there's nostalgia stuff being done for, oh, this took place in 2020 when it's all locked down and nobody was shooting mutants yet. But, I heard like a bunch of like Zoom meeting format shows that were supposedly going to be coming out, and I haven't heard about any of them coming out, but also I really haven't been looking for them.
Well, that's how the various talk shows have been doing.
Oh yeah.
And honestly, that's one of the few shows where that actually works.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have the host who's recording from his house and he's like, you know, unshaven, he's growing a beard, whatever. And then you have the people, you know, and here's so-and-so movie star who's wearing a sweatshirt. You know, it's just, everything's just kind of, you know, frat house casual.
Yep.
But I mean, okay, that's great for the talk shows, but there are some people like my parents who need their scripted dramas. Where are their cop shows?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, another one of the shows they absolutely love is Blue Bloods. And I admit, it's good, I watch it. But I mean, and they film in New York, because it's cheaper to film on location, apparently, and I guess they get tax credits. And considering that New York, for reasons we're not going to get into, is still pretty much a hot zone, I don't know if we're going to get any shows literally this year out of New York, or if it'll be, you know, how far into 2021 will it be? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It doesn't bother me, because I don't watch a lot of network TV. But, oh, it's driving my parents crazy.
Yeah, I could see that. Especially, yeah, it's one of those, like, yeah, we didn't go to any of the conventions. or
yeah,
we just said, but it's one of those, there was no NRA annual meeting and probably not going to be one next year. I'm just saying. And there was, no, you know, no AMCOM and the Second Amendment Foundation, conference. And so it's one of those like, oh, come on. Like I had so many plans for like meeting up with people and talking with people about stuff. And there are people that I wanted to see if I could get like, in an intro. Like I wanted to at GRPC, I always bump into Rob Pincus and I always see him there and he's super nice and he's super approachable. And I've never got anything interesting to say to him. I'm just always like, hey, Rob Pincus, how you doing? And that's it. And I shake his hand and that's that. And I'm always kind of bummed about that why don't I have more to say to him? Like he's giving me every opportunity. And I definitely wanted to talk to him about, and even would see him there since he is friends with Dan Gross and introduced him and all that. I would love to have Dan Gross on the show. Like, oh my God, would that be a get? Oh, but enough of our mundane lives. There's important news afoot. We talked last week about how we'll know when the podcast comes out who the nominee is going to be, and Donald Trump has announced it.
Yeah, there were two names on the short list, Barrett and Lagoa, I believe. I'm awful with names.
I've actually never heard anyone speak her name. I've only read it, I'm not any help.
It does turn out that Amy Coney Barrett is the nominee. And this has already led to some people calling her the notorious ACB.
Which, that's kind of cool.
I admit that I enjoy it mainly because it tweaks the noses of the uptight, but I'm kind of petty.
Well, if you're uptight, you kind of deserve it.
And so she's got a really interesting stance that not a lot of judges have. And she believes that, well, at least certain felons should have their firearm rights restored.
Yeah. How do you feel about that, Aaron?
Okay. Well, I want to point out that she's not for all felons, but nonviolent felons. I believe there was a specific case. Someone was convicted of mail fraud, which is a felony. But it's like, you know, this is not a violent person. There's no reason he should lose his Second Amendment rights. You know, as opposed to someone who is, you know, convicted for assault or murder. And this is one of those things. Okay, I am more able to agree with this than I'm able to agree with other things, but I'm just going to touch on this in general. Because one of the things that's brought up is restoration of voting rights to felons. And I have to admit that I experience a bit of dissonance because my brain says, well, they've paid their debt. They're out of prison. Why shouldn't they have their rights back? But there's just that part of me that just reflexively in the pit of my stomach goes, no. And I don't really know why I feel that way, but I do. And I have to fight it. And I have to say, look, there's no rational reason why they can't. And so I have some degree of feeling about that. Although since she has specified nonviolent felons, it's a much less reaction. And so I think it's just a case of, I don't know why it makes me feel icky, but I realize that it's something I need to get over because I can't find any logical fault with it.
Well, maybe I think I might. I don't know if this is the rationale, but I have somewhat of a similar sensation that happens is that I'm kind of an anti-bleeding heart, and I overall the quote unquote bleeding heart political philosophy really upsets me. And of course, this is ACP is a nonpartisan podcast. So this is just me speaking as Weedington Elizabeth Beard that, I don't like that because when you go and try to see the best in everyone, I feel like you're ignoring the people who are the best. There are people who are just wonderful people. They would give you the shirt off their back. They're always helping people out. They're nice. They're friendly. They're inviting. They're brilliant and they bring brilliant things into this world. And I know dozens of people like this that are just amazing people. And then trying to turn around and see the good in someone who is a career criminal or a bank robber or a rapist or a domestic violence offender. I feel like kind of muddies the water on the, well, look, I'm certainly not someone that's fire and brimstone and thinks that, oh, you know, once you've done something, you've tainted your soul or anything like that. But at the same time, I joke about like, yeah, not robbing banks is easy. I do it every day. Not beating your wife is super easy. I do it every single day and have done it every single day of my life. And I have no sympathy for someone that's going to hit their wife. It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. And the same idea that even if it's mutual combat, why is that going on? But at the same time, I am also with you on the someone like Martha Stewart, who was convicted of perjury. She quote unquote lied to the FBI. And even that is kind of a dubious charge. I'm not a huge fan of Martha Stewart, but I kind of feel she was set up. But All of that being said, even if she wasn't set up, even if it was a completely rightful thing, she was trying to pull a fast one on the FBI. What does that have to do with anything about whether I trust her or not with a loaded gun? Like, it's the punishment needs to fit the crime, and taking away Second Amendment rights from someone who has done nothing violent. I've talked about it in my audio fists where people talk about, you don't have the right to shout fire in a crowded movie theater. So rights have limits. Well, the limits of the Second Amendment is you're not allowed to hurt people or murder people or threaten people with guns. When you do that, you get in trouble. Like, we will throw you in prison if you're pointing guns at people, if you're shooting people, if you're hurt, if you're threatening people with a gun, we'll put you in prison. You know, you can't put you in prison for making fun of Donald Trump's hair. But we can put you in prison for that, because that is an abuse of your Second Amendment rights. And yelling fire in a crowded movie theater or committing libel or slander against somebody is abusing your First Amendment rights in a way that is not protected. So I don't see a point in, people that are nonviolent should have their rights removed. And honestly speaking, I'm kind of halfway between the people that are, if they paid their debt to society, they're free and clear, because I kind of see that there are some people that there's kind of a gray area where someone might be showing violently impulsive nature. And if you're showing that you're not good at using your words and you're good at using your fists or other things to hurt people, you probably shouldn't have things that hurt people. But I don't necessarily know if we need to allocate incarceration space for every last one of those people. And so I kind of just think the solution in my mind for that is just to have essentially people getting their rights removed. And then after a period of time, like 5 years, they could go before a judge and say, look, I was going through a rough time in my life. I was a crappy teenager. Now that I've got my, now that I've gotten my first job and I've got a wife and a kid and I'm living the suburban lifestyle. Now I realize, you know what? All that violent stuff that I was doing was bad, and I've kept my nose clean. I've got a clean record. Please, can I have my rights restored? And I think that could go for voting rights and all the other rights that get removed from incarceration. I'm cool with that. But I feel, again, as part of my anti-bleeding heart nature, I think that people need to earn their rights back. We don't just give them back or even have them automatically roll back. Obviously, for like a nonviolent felon, I could see possibly while they're incarcerated and possibly while they're on parole that maybe you could say, oh, why don't you keep away from booze and bad people and don't own any guns. But then the moment that's all over and congratulations, you're no longer on parole, you're a free person, you do what you want, keep your nose clean, then suddenly, you can just go right to a gun shop. That I'm okay with for a nonviolent felon. But for someone that has a minor violent felony, they need to earn that trust back and they need to request it.
I agree.
This one's really just kind of a quick one. More of just it just surprised me is I've been a gun blogger since like 2010, and I was on LiveJournal before that. Yeah, I know LiveJournal, hardy har har. But one of the things that was always there and on in gun forums and all that was people that either put tape or used MS Paint to blot out the serial number on their guns, or
that was
would
me.
Chirp at somebody saying, "Oh, what are you doing? You're showing the serial number to your gun." And I'm like, who cares? And now all of a sudden I care a little bit about it. Was that this is from the firearms blog, and the title is "Notice Facebook and Google or Google and indexing your firearm serial numbers," and it shows them doing searches on gun serial numbers and actually coming up with pictures of firearms. And yeah, that's disquieting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially yeah. Given the anti-gun nature of Google, where it used to be, I loved it too. You could type in Ruger LCP and then go into the shopping tab, and it would pull up all the various gun sites, so you could get a general idea of what is this gun going for? What is the MSRP for this gun? So you could see more or less not just what it said on the website, because that's all crap. You could see what are the street prices for these guns. And now, yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
I mean, this is one of those things where by itself, it's not that disquieting. I mean, okay, yes, you can look it up by serial number. But the fact that they're doing it and some of their shady other practices leads me to wonder if they're building a database. And mm-hmm. not just of the firearm serial numbers, but... Okay, so Aaron Paulette posted a picture of this gun, and we can see the serial number on this gun. Therefore, we tie the gun to her, and we can, you know, with a high probability, you know, declare that it's hers and she owns it. So you know, she owns the Glock 26, which is no mystery, but, you know, of serial number, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, this is, I mean, I've been a gun blogger for about 10 years now, and I've not been shy about what I have, although I did blot out the serial numbers. And so I really haven't cared that people know what I have. But the fact that someone is making a database of it could potentially, although I believe they are. I can't prove it, but but why else would they do this? Mm-hmm. And so that makes me nervous because, okay, you know, anti-gun information aggregators are aggregating information involving gun serial numbers. Why? What's it to them? So, yeah, that worries me.
Well, when you get also the fact that, like, there are several gun bloggers that or gun vloggers that I watch on YouTube that have, like, spun off channels that do not deal with guns at all. Matt Carricker, one of my personal favorites. He, of course, has Demolition Ranch, but he also has Off the Ranch, which is essentially his family vlog channel where he's just doing his day-to-day stuff. He's mostly like working on cars and he's an entrepreneur, so he talks about his different businesses, you know. And then he's also got Vet Ranch, which is all about his veterinary practice and the veterinary practice of a couple of other people that he's partnered with. And
I thought he was a dentist.
Nope, veterinarian.
Huh, okay.
And so he's done that, and specifically, like, he'll be, especially on his Off the Ranch channel, like, he will mention daily vlog type stuff. Oh, yeah, well, I'm stopping by the gun store, but he won't say gun store. He actually says pew pew, and actually a lot of people will say that. And there's a whole bunch of other people that are sanitizing their videos so that they are talking about guns obliquely because YouTube and Google are so anti-gun that they will actually take punitive action against people who are legally exercising their Second Amendment rights, and that is really disquieting.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you said YouTube and Google, but you repeat yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they are technically separate entities under the Alphabet, but I refuse to talk about Alphabet because it's the dumbest company name ever. They should be ashamed of themselves. But yeah, the fact that there is, like, so much anti-gun stuff where they've essentially got it so that the search engine doesn't really work for gun stuff anymore, and their content delivery system, they're punishing content creators because they're having the wrong kind of fun. I don't like the way this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, also, it's Google, so it's one of those, like, I use an Android phone. Yeah, it also, it's phone in the mothership about everything I'm doing. And so, ugh. Terminator movies, they had Skynet. Like, at least that was a cool name for like an evil mega corporation. The evil mega corporation is going to be Alphabet.
All right. So that's some bad news, but I've got some good news that I'm happy to report. And what's curious about this is that this happened like almost a month ago. It happened the 8th of September, and we're recording this on the 28th. So literally 20 days later, I'm just now hearing about this. And so Weird hadn't heard about this. I don't know if anyone's heard about this. It's been very quiet.
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about this before the show started. You're like, yeah, it's an old story. I kind of feel a little bit weird talking about something this old on the podcast. And I'm like, I haven't heard about this. And like all the gun nuts that I rub elbows with on a daily basis haven't talked about this. And so the fact that I suspect this is going to be news to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. All right. So enough foreplay. What we're talking about here is that the 10th Circuit, which is based in Denver, agreed to an en banc petition to a lawsuit. And this was a Utah gun rights advocate who I've never heard of before, W. Clark Aposhian. And he is essentially suing the bump stock ruling. And as a result of this 10th Circuit ruling, the bump stock regulation, whatever you want to call it, has been vacated pending a rehearing. So they have been granted a certification for an en banc a hearing regarding the legality of the bump stock ban. And this is important for a couple of reasons. And I think we've already hit on some of them in previous episodes. You know, it's the whole seizure without restitution and no grandfathering. The big one is the whole, okay, legislation can be done not by vote of Congress like it should be, but just with an act of regulation. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is challenging. It's a principle known as Chevron deference. And I'm not going to get too deep into it because it's a rabbit hole. But the short version of it is that Chevron deference is a precedent that was set back in 1984. And it essentially means that the government and the courts are happy to defer to government agencies as to the legality of things. And this is what enables, among other things, the ATF to get away with their own shenanigans. Mm-hmm. What shenanigans? Well, just as an example, so you remember how at first people were shouldering them.
Arm brace.
And it wasn't really a thing. And then people started writing the ATF, and the ATF says, okay, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. It's illegal! It's illegal, it's illegal, it's illegal. Well, okay, maybe it's legal if you occasionally shoulder it. Don't make a habit of it, and we'll let it go. That sort of thing, that's Chevron deference. You know, they are writing their own code that they have to live by, and that's wrong, because people who enforce the law shouldn't be able to write the law. Mm-hmm. You know, cops do not get to write traffic regulations. They have to enforce them. And so if this gets overturned, I'm not saying it will destroy Chevron deference, but it'll be a big strike against it. And that is huge. And so Pink Pistols hasn't done anything yet, but I found out about this. And I am not the go-to person for the legislative action. That's Gwen Patton. She still has all the contacts, but it was like, Gwen. Look at this, read this. We got to do something about this. So I can't guarantee it, but I'm going to push so dang hard to get Pink Pistols to write an amicus curiae brief on this, because I want Chevron deference to go down.
Yeah, just the idea that, yeah, the law means whatever the ATF feels like in that moment. And you can have things like the precursor to the bump stock is another great example, the Aikens accelerator, where where I forget what his first name was, but the gentleman's last name was Akins, and he created essentially a stock for a 1022 that was very similar to a bump stock. And he sent it to the ATF. They looked at it. They said, oh, yeah, we tried to install it on a 1022. We could get it to work, but we looked at your technical drawings. We looked at the product, and it's totally fine. And so he tooled up. He started investing in a factory to start making these things, and they were really, really cool. I think the difference between them and bump stocks is they actually had a spring inside so that it would actually return on its own. On its own power. And I think that was what later the ATS deemed was what made it naughty. But then they turned around and said, oh, wait a second. Now we've seen like a bunch of your pre-production videos and marketing stuff. And yeah, we've decided it's a machine gun. And so he just suddenly had tooled up an entire factory. And so he went bankrupt because, yeah, there was nothing he could do about it. He had just spent a whole ton of money and he was not going to make a red cent for it. So he just had to back away from all of that. And that's just disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of disgusting, this is something that popped back up during the midterm elections. And now it is happening again. I have a link in the show notes for two campaign videos made by Everytown. So that's Michael Bloomberg's anti-gun group. And
I want to interrupt. Their proper full name is Everytown for Gun Safety.
Well, why would you bring that up, Aaron? Why would you say such a thing? Everyone knows that. What is the significance about them being Everytown for Gun Safety?
Well, thank you for asking, Weird. I bring it up because these two videos are not about gun safety at all. They are, in fact, about something else. One, if not both of them, are about healthcare mm-hmm. and Trump care and you know, wearing masks and things like that. And essentially, they aren't doing what they are licensed to do. Now, admittedly, this is owned by Michael Bloomberg, and he's got the lawyers and the money, and he can get away with pretty much anything. But I feel like if this were any other charity, they would be taken to task by the IRS for operating outside of their purview.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know about the charitable laws. I'm just more interested in the fact that they are absolutely a single issue group. They are allegedly bipartisan. I mean, they do have some members that identify as independent and Republican, but as a general rule, they are almost exclusively a Democrat organization. Though I will note that Michael Bloomberg himself has been every political moniker under the sun in his political career. But yeah, the fact that all of a sudden they are giving gun control a good leave and a low. And these are evidently mass market ads. So these are playing on, like, actually I heard about it from a story of someone saying that they saw it during a sports game. And so these are mass market ads. And like I said, during the midterm, so that would be 2018, just before the election, Everytown put out a bunch of ads, and they were all about women's health care, you know, specifically like Planned Parenthood funding and things like that. And yeah, that's all they were talking about. And I've got to say, I won't lie, I'm pretty pleased with this, because it is showing that gun control is not popular. Gun control is a third rail, and they are giving it a good old leaving alone. Michael Bloomberg still got his billions of dollars, and he still wants to get the right people elected. And of course, I've played audio fisks of both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden to show that they are Donald Trump. We just talked about Donald Trump's bump stock ban, so I'm not saying that he is the pro-gun candidate. But I will say that I have not done an audio fisk on Donald Trump yet, because there really isn't that much audio to go on. There's been a lot of goofy things that he said and ignorant things that he said, but not the targeted anti-gun rhetoric that you get out of the Biden and Harris campaign. And so that's the direction that Everytown is now turning, is the don't talk about gun control. Just talk nice about the people who want more of it.
Yeah, I knew things had taken a turn when both the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign were denouncing the riots.
Mm-hmm.
because previous to that, at least some members on the left were saying that, you know, riots are protest and free speech and the language of the unheard. And so when both sides are, I mean, they're blaming each other, but when both sides are saying this thing that is happening is bad, you realize things have gotten really bad.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like we talked about earlier, when Bloomberg actually runs an article on gun safety for new gun owners, this is pretty obvious that people are buying guns for defense, for urban unrest, and yeah, no one wants to touch gun control at all. I hope that, assuming we still have a nation at the end of this, that 2020 will be the year that puts the final nail in the coffin of gun control. That's my hope. That's my silver lining.
I mean,
I'm not really confident it'll happen, but that's my hope.
I think it'll take longer. As I said to people, I've had some people say to me about the, oh, I mean, you're so, you know, rabidly pro-gun and all that, and you believe that the Second Amendment protects like everything. Again, I think we should be able to buy machine guns in gas stations. That's where I stand on the Second Amendment, and I think our founding fathers would have no problem with that. They were owning full on military hardware, and private citizens owned warships, and the largest navy in the world at the time was owned by the British East India Company, a privately owned company. So. And they had no permits or anything like that, or special treaties or carve outs to allow them to have all these arms and soldiers. I think the founding fathers who wrote the Second Amendment would probably pretty much not see any issue with my thoughts. But as I say, like, oh, well, why isn't all these gun control laws being rolled back? And I'm like, we didn't get here in a weekend. It's not like all of a sudden we just had like all the gun control just came. This happened very, very gradually over decades and decades and decades, if not centuries, depending on where you want to put the low tide mark of when it, you know, gun control really first started taking off in America. And it's going to take us maybe not exactly as long, but if it took us a long time to get here, we're not going to get back quickly. But,
well, I mean, I didn't say it was going to be instantaneous, yeah. But I figured, you know, historians can look back and say, well, you know, 2020 was the year that you know, it finally, you know,
I think that was the turning point. That may, I mean, we may be wrong, but I think that is a very astute observation. I think that would be great, is that, yeah, this is the point where, yeah, both sides are like, no, we should have guns and we should have lots of guns and we should have the type of guns that are social guns, not hunting and sporting guns. Like it or not, certifications and licenses are here to stay in most societies. Xander is going to give his independent thoughts in a segment entitled Certifiable Certificate of Certification.
I am pretty sure Weird's attempts to say the title of the segment will end up in a blooper reel. Anyway, welcome to Xander's Independent Thoughts with yours truly, Xander Opal. Skills are perishable. You go out, take some classes, get some knowledge and a piece of paper that says you know those things. Then you go try to apply that knowledge and learn all the details about how to do things. Then you stop doing those things for a while and try again later, only to realize just what you've forgotten. One of my best professors once told me that it is good that people can forget things. The loss of a loved one or family member eases over time as the memory of the pain fades. I was in his class to relearn algebra, as I'd not used most of it for many years. As I record this, I'd recently recertified my IPC soldering and inspection training. Those certifications are good for 2 years, because by the end of 2 years, people are forgetting things or have begun to substitute their opinions for facts. More rarely, best practices change and retraining is needed. Firearm skills and knowledge is like that as well. Muscle memory fades, patterns of motion are forgotten. Things that you do by feel, you have to do by thought and hope you remember all the steps. Load, charge or cock, aim, fire, and I need to stop anticipating that recoil. Recover, fire, unload, clear, safe. Disassemble, clean, reassemble. Further, there's the state and local laws you need to be keeping up on. You'd think that all these places with required registration and licensing would take advantage of those lists and send out a notice of new or changed regulations to help people stay within the law, he said innocently. And now, I will turn it over to Aaron, who will probably bring up Mag 40 and Mag 80. Have fun, be safe, I hope I gave you something to think about.
Hey, you got it right the first time.
I know, I was trying so hard. I might have practiced beforehand. Xander does write good titles for his segments, and so I do make it a point to reproduce them on the podcast. So because you aren't, guys aren't seeing the raw files that I'm working with here.
So I have to ask, am I really such a broken record about Mag 40?
I mean, no, because it's that good and that awesome, and I need to take Mag 40 as well. Like, I'm wrong.
Yeah, you do. One of the neat things about Mag 40, here I go again, is that it is taught across the country by graduates of his program. And I don't know at what point they're qualified to teach. You know, it because they go up. It's not just Mag 40. There's Mag 40, there's Mag 80, there's Mag 120. I think by about the Mag 180 or higher, at some point you're qualified to, if you want to, teach your own classes, but it takes lots and lots of hours. And so, you know, I'm sure that they have them across the country. But I do have to say, if it's at all possible, attend the classes in Live Oak, Florida, because that's where Massad is. And, you know, he's not super old, but he's in his early 70s, and he smokes too much. And he's been in at least one helicopter accident. You know, the man leads an interesting life, and he tells really great stories. And so get training under him if possible. Just bask in the awesomeness that is Moss, and do it once, because, you know, when he's gone forever, like Pat Rogers. You know, I never took a course with him. I'll never get to, which is unfortunate. I would love to go to Thunder Ranch and learn under Clint Smith. And I would want to learn under Clint, not someone who has taken his course. And so I have to encourage you, if at all possible, get down to Florida, because it's just, it's an experience.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Like, yeah, I need to get me to some Live Oak. One other thing I wanted to say about, like, his statement about forgetting things is, this is always one thing that I always hear is people talk about, oh, all these people in Europe, everyone in Europe speaks multiple languages. And, you know, I've met so many immigrants, and they speak wonderful English, and they still remember their native tongue, and they still speak in their native tongue, and it's great and wonderful. And then there's me, and I've taken a bunch of languages. I know a bunch of languages, and I can't do anything useful with them. And I gotta say, it's because there's no point where I can put a language to use. I studied French because I grew up in Maine, and I'm a quarter French Canadian, and I've got relatives who spoke French, and I live around places where French is routinely spoken by French Canadian immigrants. And so French seemed to be the language to take, and I never got a chance to use it. Plus, the French that I took was Parisian French. And then suddenly when you hear someone speaking Quebecois French, oh God, it's just incomprehensible. Especially if you're not already fluent. And so I had no means to practice. And then I started watching a ton of anime and all that. So I took Japanese, because why not? That'd be cool. And I had a friend who was Japanese. I worked with him in school and all of that. And so that was cool and good. And then I graduated and started working on fishing boats, where people were either speaking Sicilian or Portuguese if they weren't speaking English. And then later I started working in labs, and most of the people were speaking Mandarin in the labs that I was working in. And so I'm always trying to chase a language for which to learn, and I never get a chance to practice it. And again, if you don't use it, you lose it.
I took some Japanese classes. I've forgotten almost all of it. There are two things about Japanese that I remember, and I remember them because they're being weird. First of all, the Japanese don't count the way we do.
No, they do not.
By which I mean, okay, you know, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we use that for everything. But they have a 1 to 10 or whatever for, like, counting singular objects, and then they've maybe got something for counting groups of objects, and another one for counting people. I don't remember the specifics, but they have multiple words for numbers for counting, depending on what you're counting, and that's just strange.
Yeah, they've got words for, yeah, if you're counting people, that's a different one. If you're counting, like, pieces of a thing, you would use a different one word. So yeah, they're not, like, similar.
No, they're not. The second thing is the particle wa. Mm. And this is a particle. It's part of a sentence. It's not really a word. It doesn't translate to anything. It's a politeness indicator or intensifier. I don't remember exactly, but it was just... So this is a word that doesn't really mean anything. It just influences the rest of the sentence. Mm-hmm. Huh?
Oh, there's another one, and I don't know if you got that deep into it. They didn't teach it in my class, but instead I got from the more fluent people that I was picking things up from anime and all that, and realized that there's also gendered speech. And so there are things that a woman might say, ikimasu, let's go. But a man would say ikizo, which is same word, but one's the manly way of saying it. It's just like, oh boy. And then my wife started taking, I can't remember which one of the audio courses she was taking, but she was trying to teach herself Mandarin, and I was like listening in on the lessons and all that, and oh my god, like I couldn't even start with that language. It was so foreign and difficult for me.
So, speaking of foreign and difficult, do you have a moist nugget? If you don't know what that means, it's not a painful medical condition, nor is it what's left behind in your toilet. It's the subject of this week's Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to talk about the history of a firearm that is simultaneously heavily criticized and dearly loved. While some of the harsh comments may be justified, others are clearly unfair. Starting in 1882, the Imperial Russian government tested numerous designs in an effort to equip their military forces with a modern, small-caliber, repeating rifle. The trials rifle had to meet a number of requirements, including simplicity, reliability, and ease of manufacture. After much effort and almost 10 years of development, they decided on what was called the three-line rifle, Model 1891. This name was in reference to the caliber in the Russian Arshin measurement system and the year of adoption. One arshin is approximately a yard, and a line is almost exactly 1/10 of an inch. Therefore, 3 line equals 30 caliber, or 7.62 millimeter in diameter. Most of the world, of course, knows this rifle as the Mosin Nagant. This rifle is often unfairly maligned with disparaging nicknames such as garbage rod and potato stick, yet it is an interesting study in development and manufacturing. In continuous production from 1892 to the late 1940s, the Mosin Nagant may be the most mass-produced bolt-action military rifle in history. If not at the top of that list, it's certainly in the top 5, with an estimated 37 million rifles produced. Distinctive in appearance, the Mosin Nagant is a traditional bolt-action rifle fed from a 5-round single-stack internal box magazine that protrudes from the stock in front of the trigger guard. It has a full-length one-piece wooden stock, and the upper handguard, which is held on by 2 barrel bands, runs almost to the muzzle. While early rifles have sling swivels, later ones have a slot behind the straight pistol grip for the rear sling attachment, the other end loops through a similar slot in the forend. The bolt of the Mosin Nagant has a straight handle and is rotated 90 degrees in operation. There are 2 opposing locking lugs at the front of the bolt, similar to many Mauser rifle designs. However, these lugs lock in the horizontal position compared to the vertical lockup of the Mauser. Similar to the British Lee Enfield family of rifles, the Mosin Nagant uses interchangeable bolt heads. The 1891 rifle incorporated elements from many other designs and was optimized for the Imperial Russian manufacturing capabilities. Like with the Italian Carcano, it may not have been the best rifle, but it was good enough and production was manageable within their limitations. Production began in 1892 at the Tula, Ishvek, and Sestroitec state arsenals. In addition, an order for a 500,000 rifles was placed with French state arms factory Manufacture Nationale des Armes de Châtellerault. Prior to the First World War, the Imperial Russian government also placed orders for over 3 million rifles with Remington and Westinghouse in the United States. After the turmoil of the October 1917 revolution and control of the country falling to the Bolsheviks, the new Soviet government refused to pay for these contracts. Over 250,000 American-made Mosin-Nagant rifles were brought up by the U.S. government and used in a variety of ways. This included being issued to American and British troops in 1918 during the North Russia campaign, military training rifles during Model 1903 and Model 1917 rifle production shortfalls, and used by National Guard and ROTC units. Following World War I, these American Mosins were sold on the civilian market through the Director of Civilian Marksmanship for fairly low prices. More recently, the Russian government disposed of a very large number of Mosin-Nagant rifles on the international surplus market, many of which, of course, found their way to the United States. When they initially hit the market, they sold for less than $100 a rifle, sometimes considerably less than that price. I know people who bought entire transit cases of a dozen rifles with accessories for under $1,000. Over the years, there were a number of design and manufacturing changes to the 1891. These included changing the hex-style receiver to round, simplifications in order to increase production, different barrel lengths for infantry rifles, dragoon rifles, and carbines, different styles and attachment methods for the bayonet, as well as variations from factory to factory, and different national markings from use in Allied countries. When Finland split from the Russian Empire in 1917, they took their Mosin-Nagant rifles with them. During the Winter War and the Continuation War, many more were captured by the Finnish military. These were often reworked in Finnish arsenals and will show an interesting combination of markings and part sources. With some of the Finnish re-arsenaled rifles, the receiver is all that's left of original Russian manufacture. As has been said, the Mosin-Nagant is one of the only rifles to go to war with itself and win. All these markings and variations leave plenty of opportunity for the collector. To help make sense of all this, there are two main collector resources: the Mosin-Nagant rifle by Bill Harriman and the Mosin-Nagant rifle by Terence Lappin. Yes, both books really do have the same title. In addition, there are many web-based resources. 7.62x54r.net is a good example.
Здравствуйте, Chair Weird. Please to be putting links in show notes, or I will break you.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. To find our Facebook page, just type ass in the search bar. You'll find us. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
By the way, Aaron, loved the Russian Russian swagger at the end. Thank you very much.
Well, I told you that I recorded a bunch for you, and so when David mentioned he was doing the Mosin-Nagant, I'm going, oh, I hope he does my Russian one, and he did.
Awesome. I was wondering if you recorded that specifically for that segment, or it was just there.
Oh no, it was months ago. I've done a whole bunch of different accents.
Wonderful. But yeah,
I can't speak Russian, but I can fake it really well.
Yep. And Aaron and I both have Mosin-Nagants. Do you just have just the one?
Just the one.
Oh, how can you have just one? How can because you not get like a baker's dozen of Mosin-Nagants?
Because I don't have the room for them. And if I'm going to spend that money, I'm going to spend them on different guns.
That's true. though all my Mosins are different.
Okay.
The closest I've got to similar Mosins as I have, I have one Ishkvesk hex receiver 9130 and one round receiver one, which by the way, putting those two side by side, just looking at them is really cool because you can see like the cost cuttings. The machining is so bad on the round receiver one because they were just, the war was going on and they were getting as many guns out to the front as they could.
So there are two things. Maybe three if I think of them, that I want to point out. I mean, David did a good job, but he missed things that I think are critical and you should know. So the reason that the most common model of the Mos Negant is called the 9130 is because the original Mos Negant model was designed in 1891, but then they upgraded it in 1930, and they gave it some modernized designs. Now, why they just added a slash 30 and called it the M1891/30 as opposed to, you know, the M1930, I don't know, but that's why. Secondly, the reason it's called the Mos Negant. Now, when the rifle was, well, actually before it was adopted, there was a competition, a contest. The designs were submitted. So when they were looking for designs, there were actually three that were submitted for evaluation. The third one you've never heard of, Captain Zinoviev. But the two that the design committee really liked, there was one by Captain Sergei Ivanovich Mosin of the Imperial Russian Army. And another design was submitted by Leon Negant of Belgium. And so they put the rifles through their paces. And so, you know, the rifles were submitted in 1889 and the trials concluded in 1891. And the evaluators were split. It's like, well, we like this part of Mosin's rifle, but we don't like this other thing. Negant's rifle is this thing we like, but it doesn't do this thing. And so what they did, and I'm a little bit hazy on this. I'm sure there'll be historians who will pipe up with actually. But it seemed like what they did was they went, okay, we're going to largely take Sergei Mosin's rifle, but we're going to add on some things from Leon Negant that we really like. And so that's why it's called Mosin Negant. And that's, it. Well, you know, the two designers. And that's also why it's not called Negant Mosin, because it's primarily Sergei Mosin's rifle. Now, there's also a pistol called the Negant pistol. So don't call your Mosin Negant a Negant. Call it a Mosin. Because if you call it a Negant, people will think that you're referring to the Negant pistol, which is what, 7.62 by 25?
28.
28. Thank you. So Mosin is rifle, Negant is pistol. That is how it is.
Yeah. And also there's a whole family of Leon Negant made a whole bunch of different types of revolvers. So there is the Russian Negant revolver. There's also several Belgian ones. And you go on Forgotten Weapons and just search Forgotten Weapons and Negant, and you'll get like a whole bunch of stuff that you've never even seen before. Like, and because, yeah, Leon Negant was very prevalent in Belgium as a gun designer. So one thing I got to say when we're talking about Mosins, and this is really a plea. This is somebody hear my call for help. One of the crown jewels of my Mosin collection is an 1891 Westinghouse. I actually have a Massachusetts made Mosin Negant. And it's of course, David talked about the fact that, yeah, the Patriotic Revolution happened in the middle of the contract and the Tsar got overthrown and he didn't pay his bill. So Remington and Westinghouse just kept a lot of the rifles. So some did make it over to Russia, but most of them did not. Some were used by Pershing in the Military Expeditionary Force and that sort of stuff. But most of them stayed in the country. And I think that's what mine is. And the big key that I have for it is that my rifle has an 1891 Krag bayonet lug affixed to the barrel. And so that makes me think that it was possibly in one of those National Guard groups where they're not going to make them stick the tomato steak on it. But you know what? We got a whole bunch of these Krag bayonets. We can have them do bayonet drills with these, you know, American made Russian rifles. And they're good enough for target practice. They're good enough for arms manipulation. They're good enough for bayonet training. But it's one of those, like, when I suddenly saw that, I'm like, yeah, there's no way this is like a sporterizing. Elmer Fudd didn't put a bayonet lug on it and specifically put a US Krag Jorgensen bayonet on it. I think I might have given the wrong year designation for the U.S. Krag, but it's a Krag Jorgensen bayonet lug, and so yeah, I I need to know, like, if there's, where can I look? The thing's got cartouches on it. I mean, the thing's almost over 100 years old, so it's, a lot of them are hard to read. So if I knew what I was looking for, I could probably say, oh yeah, that's definitely it. But the, I know I talked with Ian McKellen for just a short period of time on this, and he was like, oh yeah, look, does it have a such and such symbol on it? And I'm like, it looks like a cactus in a flower pot. Is that what you're talking about? And he's just like, he just got frustrated, and that was the end of that. I didn't know what I was looking for, and I've got a couple of the books that David was talking about, and yeah, they don't go down the rabbit hole on where I need to know the story of my rifle. I want to know, what have you been doing for the last 100 years?
So yours is chambered in 54R?
Correct. Yep. All of mine, I don't have any of the, I mean, the only ones that are technically, there's the, what is it? I think they call it 53R, the fins slightly improved. They rebarreled some of their Mosins in 308 caliber. But they're still using the same cartridge. And so they've got a slightly modified round. And I believe they call it 7.62 by 53R is what shoots best in the Finnish Mosins. But all of mine are in just standard 7.62 by 54R. And all of them are essentially comm block manufactured rifles, with the exception of the Massachusetts made Westinghouse. And I have a White Army Tula.
Ooh. Yeah, I was just wondering if maybe yours had been rechambered in, you know, 30-06 or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's still got the original barrel. I mean, I think Mosins are kind of a pain in the butt to rebarrel, and I think at the same time, I think the ammo was plentiful enough that it was just a question of let's just give them something to shoot.
All right, fair enough.
I mean, especially the mindset has changed. I mean, nowadays we only shoot military ball. Like, even when you're target practicing, you're shooting at the same stuff that you're going to be shooting in the battlefield. But like, Mossberg got their start making 22 rifles for the army to train on. And like, when was the last time there was a vet that actually shot rimfire in basic training?
I don't know.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/AssortedCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworlds.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
So by the time you hear this, we touched on it last week, but not a whole lot. So you should have heard my very good speech at the Virtual Gun Rights Policy Conference. If you haven't heard it, shame on you, but you can find it everywhere. I spammed it like everywhere. I think I put it in the ACP Facebook group. So it's all over the place. And I've got another one coming up next month. I don't remember precisely the date or the name, so I'll get back to you on that soon. But I'm going to have another thing that'll be coming up. And other than that, you can find me at the usual places, Blue Collar Prepping, Lurking Rhythmically, which I haven't done a lot on lately for shame, and of course, pinkpistols.org and blazingsword.org.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
You know, it would be really funny if I could do this in Russian, and unfortunately I can't.
So, weird is puny little duck man who quacks too much, and Erin is Bolshoi beautiful Ponzarina. Styles are sorted, da, and so is podcast. Dovidanya.
Good night, everybody.